Hello, this is The Game Podcast from The Times, and I'm Natalie Sawyer. Gregor Robertson is with me as per usual, and today Martin Ziegler joins us. Gregor and Martin, lovely to have you with us today. Martin, how are you doing? I know the last time you were with us, you were telling us about how busy you have been, considering there is no football. I'm guessing that's still the same for you.
Absolutely still the same. If anything, more busy than the last time.
Oh my goodness. It's like the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know, if just the Premier League alone, they've got meetings tomorrow, they've got meetings on Wednesday, they've got meetings on Thursday. So trying to get football back up and running is something that's spending, everybody in the clubs and the Premier League are spending a huge amount of time trying to do, and also the Championship as well.
Absolutely. Yes, we'll get on to that in just a moment. But while Martin is busy trying to work out what's happening with Project Restart, Gregor, you've been sunning yourself, I hear.
I don't want to. I'm doing some work.
I know you are.
I'm at that stage of lockdown where, you know, Susie informed me today that it was a bank holiday. I had no idea of that whatsoever. I barely know what day it is these days.
I know, you're absolutely right. I had to go out earlier on, and I was thinking, gosh, this is taking me a lot quicker to get out and about. And then it dawned on me, it must be a bank holiday, but I hadn't even thought about it. But are you keeping well, Gregor?
Yes, very well. How are you?
Yes, I'm very, very well. Just in terms of the shade that you'd call yourself right now, are we a nice brown? Or are we a salmon pink? Where are we at?
Yeah, somewhere between salmon and lobster pink, I think that's probably the best description.
Say no more. Lovely. Say no more indeed. Now, coming up, we're examining the moral issue facing the EFL as it looks into government bailouts to halt its financial crisis. And we'll be looking back at some famous on-this-dayers for the 25th of May. Liverpool fans won't want to miss it. All that to come after this.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, the back page of the Times today reads, League drops plan for hotel quarantines. News that the Premier League will not require players to be quarantined in a hotel for either 1 week or two before matches resume. Now, the practice was used in Germany for the week before the resumption of the Bundesliga season to reduce the risk of COVID-19 infection. However, it's understood that the idea has been dropped and does not feature in draft plans for the Premier League's protocol for when games resume, which is expected to be on June the 19th or more likely June the 26th, all behind closed doors, of course. Now, Martin, you've written this piece for The Times, so is this a reason for us to be cheerful that football is getting closer to resuming?
Yes, I think it's one of the hurdles that had to be crossed. The Premier League's medical advisor, Mark Gillette, said last week that they were going to be looking at this idea of a quarantine period before the first match. That ran into a few problems. A, there's not many hotels that are actually open. The other thing, I think quite a few of the players were sort of questioning whether this was what they thought was something they wanted to do. Did they want to be taken away from their families at a point like this for 2 weeks? I think that was probably a bigger hurdle. And also, I think there was generally a thing, what's the point if we're testing so many times? Is there really any point to doing this? The Germans did it for a week. Mark Gillette said that we need to do it for 14 days to have any significant effect. So I think the Premier League looked at it and then decided we can do it without this, which I think is probably a positive thing.
Yeah. I mean, with the recent round of testing, which has revealed two positive results from the 996, you can understand why officials are optimistic that with infection rates low, hotels won't be required for quarantine purposes, Martin.
Yeah, I think the infection rates that And we had six last week out of I think it was about 748, wasn't it? And then and then two out of 996. It just shows that actually we're talking tiny numbers, and that's not players, that's staff as well, coaches. I mean, we knew that Burnley's assistant coach was one of those who tested positive. So we are looking at the situation where it's very, very few people involved. So with a bit of luck, that continues, and the things will be a bit more straightforward when it comes to getting back into training and then getting matches restarted, which, as we say, is slipped definitely from June the 12th to the 19th, but almost certainly it's going to be the 26th, I think.
Mm. Gregor, as more details emerge about the return of football, does it excite you, or are you actually still apprehensive about it all?
I'd say somewhere in the middle. I'll put optimistic. I wasn't beforehand, and I think really those first raft of tests were a huge kind of leap forward with the numbers. You know, any positive tests were some concern, but they're very small, and it's even the same in the Championship recently. I think there was two. So, you know, I think we're still at the kind of mercy of external forces. Obviously, as I've seen, the infection rate is falling. The next hurdle is, of course, when phase two kicks in of the training protocols, which everyone's discussing this week, and the players come into contact more often, and so if there is any positive test, you know, anyone catches coronavirus, essentially, then there's more risk potentially in spreading through a team. But as Martin says, the risks appear to be pretty minute. So as long as that trajectory remains downwards in the rest of the country, then I think really we're taking some big steps forward towards football returning.
Mm. I mean, we know that some footballers have been quite vocal, Gregor, about not wanting to return. Troy Deeney obviously has his reasons with regards to family members that he doesn't want to expose to the virus. But do you think if you were a footballer still playing today and you heard these testing results and how it seems to be affecting only a small, and I say small, it's very small minority of players right now, that it would make you feel like perhaps football is a safe place to return to?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was enormous. It was, you know, even the players who did test positive, I think, by all accounts, were asymptomatic. And it's, I just feel that they are very small numbers. And I think there's a kind of, from what I understand, speaking to one or two players, there's a pretty strong consensus there won't be any hurdles. There are still concerns. As you say, Troy Deeney and others have voiced concerns that really are going to be pretty impossible to answer for quite some time. So, you know, those concerns still exist. But I don't foresee there being any problems in taking the next step into full contact training. And that's another big step towards the return of football.
Well, you mentioned that conversations are going to be taking place. It is a big week ahead for Project Restart, with clubs meeting on Wednesday and Thursday to discuss a host of matters, including the return or players being allowed to have full contact training or some contact training this week. The exact date for the restart of football will also be discussed, as will TV scheduling and what system should be used to decide on the outcome of the league should the season have to be curtailed. The issue of whether relegation should be scrapped is expected to be raised by at least one club, but it looks unlikely to win widespread support as well. So Martin, when you hear all of these points that need to be discussed this week, how crucial is it for Project Restart?
First of all, the first thing is getting the second phase of training agreed, which is the contact training, which I think is, as Gregor said, it looks like the players are getting behind this, and it will probably will be approved on Wednesday, and then on Thursday things become a bit trickier. We're around the plan of what will happen if the season is curtailed. I think that'll be some heated discussions around there. I'm not even sure there'll be a vote, but I think there'll be some sort of determination that it's going to be decided on sporting merit. And I think the FA have already made it perfectly clear that they're not going to sanction no relegation. So I think that's probably off the table. I'm sure that there will be an effort made to try and get that approved by a couple of clubs. So it's probably the most important week for the Premier League for since the suspension of play back in mid-March, because there's so much on the table. In fact, there's probably never been two Premier League shareholders meetings on consecutive days since it started in 1992. I think that's how serious this is.
Mm. And do you really think, Martin, then by the end of this week we could be given a start date for the Premier League?
They might give us a revised one or a revised target. I mean, June the 12th was always a target rather than the actual start date. So I wonder if they'll just revise the target and make that June the 26th.
So June the 26th, which is just over a month's time then, Gregor, from a footballer perspective, is that enough time to get ready to resume football?
Yeah, I think the players want 4 weeks of full contact training. So that's just about there. I think the one possible issue still, and I don't think this is going to hold things up, but I still think there might be some hesitancy about signing the kind of waivers almost. I think that partly that might be to do with the PFA. I think they're quite reluctant to advise the players to sign these waivers, which, you know, there's still this whole issue about liability if the worst should happen. So, as long as we can proceed without that happening, I'm sure we still will. But I still think that there will be reluctance from the players to basically sign a form saying that they're risking their life, even how small it is. Mm. So that'd be interesting to see, I think, in the coming days.
Well, Martin, just lastly on that and on the point that Gregor has made, do you know if that is a conversation that will be taking place at some point this week? And also the subject of contracts and players' contracts who are running out at the end of June. Do we know where we're at with that?
I think we do know on that, because the clubs voted last week to accept that those could be extended until the end of the season, certainly up until July the 31st. So I think we're okay with the contracts. I think the issue of waivers is definitely an outstanding issue. And I think that it's not just the players that are worried about that. It's the clubs, the directors. Would they be liable for you know, in the worst case scenario, if a player caught COVID and died, would the directors then be liable for effectively corporate manslaughter, which is obviously extreme, but it's something that lawyers will have to look at and judge. So that's another obstacle, and I think they'll just have to make a decision on the liability factor there.
So we are getting closer to Project Restart in the Premier League. Championship clubs this week are resuming training at their grounds. And I know, Gregor, you've been writing about the EFL for the Times and whether government bailouts could be the only way to ensure the preservation of the EFL. It's an idea that's been proposed by Damien Collins, the former chairman of the Digital Culture, Media and Sport Committee, and also Charlie Methven, the co-owner of Sunderland, who many people will recognise from Netflix's Sunderland Till I Die, or as Gregor affectionately calls him, the accidental David Brent of the series. I'm sure he loves that, Gregor. Now, they have proposed a six-point plan, which includes the creation of an independent body, the Football Finance Authority, and would still need finer details to be worked out on how clubs would pay back the bailouts to become self-sufficient once more. Perhaps, Gregor, you can just tell us a little bit more to this situation then that you've been finding out with regards to the EFL.
Well, Damien Collins, and the first thing to say is it's surprising how kind of far-reaching this report was, and who the authors were. I think I said in the piece, it's kind of for a conservative pair of conservatives, a conservative MP and a conservative policy consultant to advocate potentially, like, you know, government bailout of football clubs, and potentially kind of to allow supporters or local authorities to buy the stake in the football clubs at a future date over a period of time. You know, you'd think you were living in La La Land a few months ago. and it is, you know, it's very bold. I think this is something that Supporters Direct, it's what is now known as Football Supporters Association, have been kind of advocating for probably a couple of years now, and any supporters of clubs such as Portsmouth in the past or Blackpool, clubs who've had really, really awful times because of their ownership, they've been pushing for this, and it's a step towards a kind of an independent body that would oversee the EFL's rules and regulations on finances, and enforce them, because that's always been a huge issue. Basically, the EFL seems impotent when it comes to enforcing rules about, you know, the owners and directors test or financial fair play regulations. So it's kind of fairly wide ranging, and also I think it's I'll be brutally honest, I think it's quite unlikely, but I think there is room for government to lend a hand at this moment in time. But as I said before, we live in extraordinary times, and a lot of people will have problem with the fact that football is such a wealthy industry, it's at the top anyway, and the Premier League has so much money, and we all expect that the Premier League, or hope the Premier League, should lend a hand at the moment. We're talking about a 200 million black hole, as Rick Parry, the EFL chairman, said. Others think Mark Palios, being the Tranmere chairman, thinks it could be far more. And this is the problem. Football clubs, when they don't have a £1 billion TV deal, as the Premier League do, are losing up to half their income by having no supporters through the gates, if they start at all next season. So this is the question. There's a huge black hole. And I just thought it was worth... You know, this report was released on Friday, and it made a few lines in most newspapers, but I think it's worth actually considering. It may not be in exactly this shape or form, but I know as well, having spoken to a number of club owners, that this has been raised in the EFL meetings, possibly in a different way. They would probably be reluctant to give up a stake in their football clubs, but they have spoken about the potential of government loans, probably weighted against future TV deals. So it's not impossible.
It's interesting though, isn't it, Martin? Because often when you speak to people outside of football, they'll often talk about the riches in football, but they're obviously referring to the Premier League and not necessarily League Two clubs. And many won't have sympathy though for football clubs because of the finances that are involved. Do you think if the government were to get involved and to perhaps help bail them out, that there is a moral issue there at stake?
I spoke to people from inside Whitehall last week on this. They are very, very strong that it's not up, you know, they're not willing to step in and give money to football or any other sport really, apart from rugby league, which they have committed to because they're hosting the Rugby League World Cup next year. So I think it's very, very difficult for government to prop up football clubs when what they say they want to see is the Premier League sharing their money more widely down the football pyramid. And I think it's just about the only way it's going to work.
I mean, I was speaking to the Huddersfield owner earlier on today, and he is alarmed at the situation in the EFL and further down the footballing pyramid, it has to be said. What was striking about the conversation with Phil Hodgkinson was that he was saying that all the conversations that seem to be taking place in the EFL right now, Gregor, are all about how do we restart the season. No one is discussing the future long-term impact of coronavirus and how that is going to affect the footballing pyramid. And that's the discussion and the conversation that Hodgkinson wants to have now, so that he believes, I should say, he thinks 50 or 60 clubs could go if we don't start these conversations now. And that's quite alarming.
I agree absolutely, emphatically. I think that, you know, I understand why all the kind of hand-wringing and hair-pulling at the moment is about finishing the season. Teams don't want to be relegated. Other teams want to have the chance of promotion or to fight for playoffs. I understand. But it is obscuring the bigger issue, which is next season. Because it's fairly widely accepted at the moment that probably at least until January 2021, we're not going to have any supporters of stadiums. I mean, you look at what the sheer level of costs that need to be cut, especially for some clubs in League One and League Two, We're talking about asking players to take probably 50% wage cuts. And I know there is a kind of audit taking place just now, which is being done by Deloitte and the PFA. And I know I spoke to one chairman who said that was their advice, basically. You need to take 50%, have your players agree to take a 50% wage cut, or else you're going to be hemorrhaging money. And that is not going to be easy. The PFA stance in this has always kind of been, if owners have the money and the means to pay their players, then they should do. I mean, it's all going to be dependent on you know, how owners' businesses have been affected by this as well. And you know, there are going to be some clubs undoubtedly in the next 2 or 3 months who are in serious, serious trouble. And really, that is the biggest issue, player costs. If you can't find a way around that, then we need. I think there's going to have to be some kind of bailout from the Premier League or government, regardless. I think, and my fear is, if it's the Premier League, then what do they ask for in return?
Indeed, there will be massive ramifications, no doubt. But let's look at some of the other money-saving alternatives that perhaps have been suggested. One is regionalised leagues. Now, it's been briefly championed by, among others, Andy Pilley, the Fleetwood Town owner, who funds losses of between 4 and 6 million annually, despite there being little, if any, evidence of significant financial gain. The other option is salary caps. Caps amounting to between 2.5 and 3 million in League 1 and 1.25 to 1.5 million in League 2 are widely welcomed and expected to come into force this summer. The proposal also may limit squads to 20 senior players. But Mark Catlin, the chief executive of Portsmouth, says a salary cap has a relevance in the long-term sustainability of football under certain circumstances, but it doesn't solve the short to mid-term problem of players who are already under contract and what clubs have already committed to while no fans are coming in to pay the bills. Of those two suggestions that I've just mentioned there, Martin, in terms of regional leagues and salary caps, do you think either of those could help?
I think salary caps will definitely help. And as you say, it will almost certainly come in, with the EFL chairman, Rick Parry's, spoken about that in very positive terms, as have quite a few of the clubs. I don't think regional leagues, I don't think there's much favour around those. I've spoken to quite a few clubs, and I think generally people don't like that. I don't think the travel issue is a big cost factor, really, for the clubs. So I think I think that would be a sort of drop in the ocean, really. I think what will happen is that market forces will prevail, and unfortunately the people are going to suffer there are the players, because in League 2 and League 1, but in League 2 especially, there's going to be hundreds and hundreds of players out of contract in the summer, and they are not going to be able to get the same sort of contract they are on at the moment, because the money's not going to be there. So I think we're going to see part-time professionals in League 2, which is, for those players who have mortgages and families, that's a really tough thing to do. But I just, that's where it's going to happen, I think.
Yeah. I mean, Gregor, can you imagine, just a few months ago, you were a full-time professional footballer, and now you are facing the possibility of either not having a club to come back to or a job to come back to, or in League 2, being a part-time footballer?
Yeah, I mean, it's hugely scary times. And obviously, we have to add that the football's not alone in this, and there are a lot of people losing jobs and
absolutely,
and facing some scary times. But, you know, it's, if football kind of comes to an end, then we're not exactly looking in a healthy jobs market elsewhere. It would be very, very scary. And I agree with Martin. I think, you know, that, I think that's ultimately true. There will be market forces will mean that there's so many players that basically the clubs will be able to offer them, and they'll have to offer them, vastly reduced contracts. But I still don't think that will make up for the financial hole that we're looking at. If these leagues have to play, then there's going to be the cost of testing. I don't know if they're going to be able to manage that. I spoke to Catlin as well, said the Portsmouth CEO, said that, you know, a lot of people have talked about the iFollow idea and perhaps raising some money by supporters paying to watch the games online or on streams, and he said their club has modelled that they would bring in between 15 and 25% of their ordinary ticket revenues through that. So, you know, if you could manage to get 25% reduction in your player wages, that still leaves a big old hole. And Portsmouth are one of the biggest clubs in League One as well. So a lot of clubs wouldn't raise enough money to pay for their testing through iFollow. So salary caps will happen. And as he said, that's a step forward, and it's a step into a bit more of a sustainable future. And I think there is a kind of understanding among owners and chairmen that this has to happen. But these are all kind of, you know, also that we hope there might be a fairer redistribution of money from the Premier League in the future. But that next TV deal is not until 2022. So these are all more long-term issues, and there is a short-term danger. And that's the thing I think really we still need to look at how that gap's going to be plugged.
I mean, for all the excitement, Martin, that we were talking about earlier on about Project Restart and there being a potential date in the diary for when we'll see the Premier League, there does need to be discussions about the future of the pyramid clubs, those lower league clubs who are dependent on those match day revenues that won't be getting that for some time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there could be some sort of fund set up. But I mean, the trouble is the Premier League clubs, they're as worried about their financial futures as anybody. So they're not going to want to hand over lots of cash to prop up the lower league club. So it's a difficult one. And as I said, the government, they're not keen either, because and it's not just football, by the way, that they're not keen to do it for rugby union or for cricket. So, and I think, you know, if they did it for football, for Premier League football, set up some sort of fund, then all other sports would say, well, what about us too? So it's an impossible thing to solve, really. And it's just one of those things where you just hope people can survive and get through it, and crowds can come back in January, and that will make up for it. But I think it's, yeah, very testing times.
The train is now approaching junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The 25th of May is a special day in the sporting calendar. 1967, if I take you back to then. Celtic became the first British club to win the European Cup, beating Inter Milan 2-1 in Lisbon. Fast forward to 1998, Charlton and Sunderland played out one of the greatest playoff finals ever at Wembley, as Charlton were promoted to the Premier League thanks to Sasa Ilić saving Mickey Gray's penalty after a 4-all epic was decided on spot kicks. 2005, Liverpool won the Champions League final, beating AC Milan 3-2 on penalties in Istanbul after recovering from being 3-0 down at half-time. We can't let the date pass then without looking back on that night in Istanbul for Liverpool 15 years ago today. Gregor, can you remember where you were at that time?
I can. I was with the Scotland under-21s. I think we had a doubleheader against Moldova and Belarus, the mighty Moldovans and Belarus, in a few days' time. So we were in a hotel, and I remember the manager, Rainer Bonhoff, German legendary midfielder, won the World Cup. He was our manager. It was during the Bertie Vogts era.
Yeah.
He
I felt like I went German then. I went, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
he allowed us all to have kind of some pizza and a beer in a room and watch the game together. And I just remember everyone jumping around the room kind of in awe and so much excitement during the game. And one player, Stephen Whittaker, who later signed for Norwich City, Norwich City fans will remember him, he had a bet that he had a 3-0 half-time and a 3-all full-time.
No.
He had a bet, and he only put like £2 on it or something. But
and
still,
when did he put that bet on?
That afternoon. We'd been, no. You know, we'd had training and we went for a little walk and stuff, and he put that bet on. And it was just, you know, that just added a little bit of an extra kind of spice to the thing as well, because everyone in the room knew that he had that bet. It was one of the all-time great games, and just remember it being a rarity that we were allowed to have some slightly unhealthy food and a beer with a football team.
Martin, do you know where you were at the time?
I can't quite remember, no.
Martin, no! I can't believe it. It's one of those things that, do you know where you were when Liverpool won the Champions League? Obviously, you were very busy. That is understandable. But when you now look back on that final, can you believe what happened in Istanbul, Martin?
All I remember about it is thinking when Liverpool got one goal back, I did think it's on now. Yeah, it did feel like it was a really, really important goal, a turning point. And I wasn't surprised when they pulled it off from half time. From what happened at half time, I actually wasn't surprised after that. Once they got that one goal back, it just, you could see what was going
to
happen.
Yeah, momentum completely shifted to Liverpool, that's for sure. I was actually in a bar, if you want to know where I was. Obviously, having some light refreshments. I'd gone with some friends, a few of which were Liverpool fans. And I do remember at halftime, one of my friends, she was crestfallen. She was heartbroken. She was adamant, that was it. You know, we've got to leave. I don't want to watch this anymore. And I, mystic Meg that I am, said, No, look, if they can score 3 in the first half, there's no reason why you can't score 3 in the second. Now, I didn't expect them to score 3. I was just trying to make her feel better. But anyhow, obviously, we remember what happened after that, and they did go on and score 3. But what makes that win more remarkable is the AC Milan side, Gregor, that Liverpool were up against. If I just remind everybody, you had Dida, you had Cafu, Maldini, Stam, Nesta, Gattuso, Seedorf, Pirlo, Kaká, Shevchenko and Crespo. Those names make you purr when you think about footballers, Gregor. Is that sort of the best side, do you think, to ever lost a Champions League final?
I mean, it's got to be right up there. I actually went to the Champions League final 2 years before that at Old Trafford between Milan and Juventus, and it was an awful game. It was nowhere near the same game, but they had very much the same team. They had Nesta, Maldini, Seedorf, Pirlo, Gattuso, Rui Costa at the time, then and Inzaghi and Shevchenko. Shevchenko scored the winner in a penalty shootout after a 0-0. But I had seen that team in action beforehand, and yeah, I mean, they were irresistible in the first half, and that goal from Crespo with the kind of Pirlo played the ball in and the through ball, and Carragher's kind of lunging to block it, and Crespo just dinks it beyond Dudek, and you thought, oh my god, it could be embarrassing in the second half here. So yeah, I mean, obviously that everyone looks back at the tactical switch that Rafa Benitez made, mm-hmm. throwing on Didi Hamann, and then Steven Gerrard just kind of became like a man possessed in the second half, and that header was remarkable, and you know, just his kind of sheer force of personality, and he was like a force of nature in that second half, and it is one of the all-time great games, I think.
You mentioned Steven Gerrard. Obviously, everybody talks about him being the hero of the night. Anyone else, though, do you think deserves more credit than they really got from that night in Istanbul, Gregor?
I think Hamann was a huge, yes, a huge switch. I think that you know, the tactical switch as well, but he was, you know, he covered some amount of ground. And then, you know, there was little clips doing the rounds of social media this morning that Jerzy Dudek made that, mm-hmm. that double save. I think it was from Shevchenko.
It was.
The second one, you know, it was ridiculous. He's just kind of getting back onto his feet on the goal line, and you know, just instinct, and it somehow went over the bar. And so, yeah, there were moments like that, and I think you know, there's moments that players reflect upon now. I think, and I think Carragher said, you know, that moment was just a moment where they thought, A, how on earth has that not gone in, and B, this has to be our night. And then you know, you just kind of look back at the celebrations. Carragher kind of, when Dudek obviously saved the penalties at the end, running around like a kind of little school kid leaping in the air, he just couldn't control himself. So, yeah, brilliant night.
Yeah, very much so. Martin, when you think back then to that Champions League final of 2005, do you think that's the best one that's ever been in terms of the story, the comeback and all that came with it?
If you were writing it as a sort of fictional story, you'd think it was so unlikely it couldn't actually happen, don't you? So from that point of view, probably it was. I mean, the venue, the place it was. I mean, I have always regretted not going to it because I went to the final the year before and the year after. And I remember why I can't remember it now, because I've just been looking back at the dates. And I was on paternity leave.
Oh, there you go. That makes sense. And you're in the baby bubble.
Everything's a bit of a blur around that time, obviously, you can imagine. And that was also, was it Vladimir Smicha? Was that his last performance? Because I know he scored an excellent goal, didn't he? Won himself a place in Liverpool fans' hearts forever, didn't he?
Yes, you're right. He left in June of that year. So, yeah.
So that was a sort of amazing way for him to sign off. I always thought he was one of these players who was really, really like, technically talented, but... And I really liked watching him, but he didn't quite get the impact that he perhaps could have had. But yeah, in terms of the final itself, it must be up there, mustn't it? Right at the very top of all the European Cup finals, and a long, long way up compared to the Milan Juventus one at Old Trafford, which was just terrible. But there've been some cracking ones. I mean, the one in Cardiff between. Real Madrid and Juventus, that was amazing as well. I mean, there have been some brilliant ones recently. So, but yeah, I don't think you'll ever forget the miracle of Istanbul.
No, I think you're right there. Although, Gregor, I know that I was discussing this a little bit earlier on and on Twitter, and somebody wrote to me saying, I don't know why everyone goes on about it being the miracle of Istanbul. Liverpool didn't actually win the game. It was a 3-3 draw. The caveat to that was he was an Everton fan. So maybe you can understand why he said that. But equally, he mentioned the game between Liverpool and Barcelona from last season. And he thought that was an even better result when it comes to Champions League matches, albeit it wasn't a Champions League final. But where do you stand on the game at Istanbul and whether or not it should be the ultimate Champions League final?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think it's, but that and obviously with a Premier League hat on, the Manchester United comeback against Bayern Munich as well. I have to say, I also remember the Arsenal against Barcelona final was another fantastic game, and Henrik Larsson came on and kind of changed the game for Barca. And, I mean, you look at the Arsenal team as well then, that, you know, Campbell, Toure, Cole, Fabregas, Gilberto, Lundberg, Henry, that was kind of almost peak Arsenal, I think, and they came so very close. And, you know, Barcelona had Ronaldinho and Eto and Deco. So, you know, that was another cracker. But I think really between the Manchester United versus Bayern Munich and Liverpool game, I think they are two of the greatest. The game at Anfield last season was a remarkable event. You know, that's something I don't think we'll really ever probably see happen again. But there's something different about a final, and it's kind of... I don't know. It's not. There's something unique about having two legs in a Champions League, in the knockout games as well, and the sort of different dimension that puts in the whole game. A final is just, you know, a complete one-off, and when you're 3-0 down at half-time, I think a lot of people would have been fearing a humiliation rather than envisaging the possibility of a comeback. So, really, it was one for the ages. Yeah.
Well, that is it for now. Many thanks to Gregor and to Martin. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. All you have to do is search The Times subscription for more information. We will be back with you on Thursday for the very latest game podcast. Do stay safe in the meantime.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.